You're listening to Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, April 30th. You can start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning April 4th, you can drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information. And on today's show, we have cellist Elisa Weilerstein. She's going to be appearing with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic at the Krannert Center in Urbana this Thursday evening. And also, Steve Poltz, who's a singer-songwriter originally from Canada, Nova Scotia specifically, and now living in San Diego, I think, or at least in Southern California. He's going to be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount, Illinois, this Saturday evening for a show starting at 7 o'clock. Very interesting character, writes some really interesting, sometimes funny, often very touching songs. And we'll have examples, I think, of all of those today on Live and Local. Hope you'll stay with us.
I'm on the mend, I'll be around to see if you would like a chance for love again. From ocean to desert sand, we'll travel across the world because it's spinning in our hand. Wherever we lay down our bedrolls is our home. We don't need much, we've got it all. We'll travel the world somehow, from mountain tops to cityscapes. We're in our dream house now. I've been a lonely gypsy, and y'all looking mother hipsy. I'll follow you till I'm tipsy, from San Diego to Poughkeepsie.
We just heard a tune called Dream House from the CD of that name by Steve Poltz. He is going to be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards this Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. And he's with us on the phone at the moment from Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're catching him earlier in the week. And pleased to have you on the phone. Thanks for joining us for the show.
No, thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
I have, my first question really comes directly off of the bio that's on your website, and I'm kind of curious to know if you wrote it or somebody else, and it says right off the bat, Steve Poltz is not normal. Did you write that?
No, the guy who wrote the bio is a guy who owns a club that I play in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I was born, and his name's Mike Campbell, and he seen me play probably 20 shows, so I just asked him if he would write the bio because he knows me pretty well, and so his first opening sentence was, "Steve Pultz is not normal."
And do you agree with that statement?
Well, I'm only a passive bystander reading it, but probably it's hard to gauge that. I think I'm normal.
Well, what do you think he meant? What do you think he meant by that?
I think what he meant was the fact that he's seen so many different shows and they've all had their own different vibe, and the fact that I'm always gone and this life that I lead is not normal. So I think that's what he meant.
Give us a little bit of the trajectory of your career and what you're doing with it right now.
Well, I've been lucky in that I've had my foot in both sides of the music industry. The one before the collapse of the music industry, where our industry was sort of decimated, like a nuclear bomb came to it, and we've rebuilt it into what it is now, and it's still the Wild West out there. So I was kind of lucky enough to come up from the way of the old school way, the way they used to do things, and then not be too old to embrace the technology and the new frontier that's ahead of us. So I'm really glad, because I liked how it was and I like how it is. And I actually like how it is better than how it was. So I think a lot of the blogosphere and all the different writers and stuff are starting to discover that, you know, there's so many people out there and we can basically write our own story. Who do we want to be and how do we want to do it? There's no gatekeeper sort of holding a velvet rope saying, okay, you can come in, but you can't come in. There still are gatekeepers to a certain effect as far as people who book festivals and all that. But if you want, you can start your own festival. You can basically do whatever you want if you have the wherewithal and the work ethic and the songs. You can go about spelunking in the musical caves and end up wherever you end up. And so for me, I really like it that way, because each tour is kind of different and I keep meeting new people and new writers and new fans and people that want to be champions of what I'm doing. And so it's fun to see how each year it gets a little bit bigger. It's a slow build, I'll tell you that much.
To slow build, audience build, you mean?
Yeah. And then it's sort of like a snowball that gets bigger and bigger, that's rolling down a hill. And eventually you have so many more venues you can play. Like for me, every year I add new venues into my list of already great venues that I'm playing in great cities and towns. And like, I just was in Australia and I did 28 shows. When I first went there, I only did probably 6. And the same with Canada. And the same with the United States, you know. I keep finding new places to play and meeting new musicians and networking. And through that, the possibilities and the list of possibilities keeps on growing. It's exciting to me.
So do I understand right that you've really been on a solo career since about 98, when you put out your first solo album? Was before,
yeah.
More working with a band...
prior to that, I was in the Rudburns.
Yeah, which is a great
one. And we were touring like crazy. And so I think I started going on the road in 1988. I left for like 9 months, and I went over to Europe, and I played on the streets as a busker, street musician, and then came back and was just living in San Diego and had a job and was playing at nights. And then I quit my job in 92, and I've never had a normal job since. I've been on the road since 1992 full-time as a musician.
And playing venues large and small.
Yeah, and once I did that, I never looked back, because once you really sort of jump off the cliff and say, this is what I'm doing, I am not going back to working a regular job. It's amazing what will happen, because you go into survival mode and your antenna are out there and you really are aware that you need to put food on the table. And if you need to do that, things will happen. You just need to just take one step forward and keep going forward. And I truly believe if you're doing good work out there and you're making good music, that the universe will take care of you. I really, really believe that, because you're in survival mode, and it's just going to happen. There's no looking back. Like, failure is not an option at that point. You have to succeed. And if you do it that way, good things are going to happen. Like, a lot of times people get in a band and they just think, well, we'll go on the road in a year after we practiced every day. I always tell bands, screw that. Start booking shows for 3 months away, and I guarantee you your practices will come together and your show will come together. And if not, you'll die a slow death on stage. But playing on stage and dying a slow death and making mistakes is like high-altitude training. It's like you can practice all you want in a little room, but until you're on stage and you play for a crowd that's sort of indifferent and you have bad monitor speakers and an unfriendly staff, that's high-altitude training. That's when you start getting your calluses, and slowly but surely those calluses get thicker and thicker, and it's stuff that you can't learn out of a book. You just have to experience it.
Do you have any good examples of ways in which you've crashed and burned on stage?
Oh, man, I remember one time we showed up at this gig, and it said, and it was in Rehoboth in Delaware, I think it was, and it said, chicken wings on the sign outside, chicken wings and a band, 10 cent chicken wings and a band. And people literally got really drunk because there was like 75 cent beers, and they started just throwing their chicken wings at us. Like, people, for whatever reason, thought this was funny and started throwing chicken wings. I had to use my guitar as a shield. I don't even know how it started. And, you know.
So it may not have been a reaction to what you were doing at all.
No, I think they were just really drunk. I've had fights break out in the audience. I've had club owners not pay me. You know, van breakdowns. I've had people quit mid-tour. I've had car accidents. I've had equipment stolen. T-shirts stolen. The whole deal. It's all stuff you have to go through. It's like a board game. And you go to or maybe it's a video game and it's the next level. Oh, we're on this level now. Okay. Now they're adding this into the mix. You know, a sound man who hates my guts.
Well, from chicken wings and hateful sound men, let's go to one of the more, well, actually one of the several tender sounding songs on your Dreamhouse CD. And this is one that you, of the ones that I mentioned to you before we started to talk here, that you'd particularly like to hear, called Medicine. What appeals to you about your own song in this case?
Medicine is totally from the heart, and it was sort of a tribute to a friend of mine who passed away a while back, and it kind of just speaks for itself. I like the guitar work on it, and we did it in one take up in Halifax. And they were doing construction late at night, and they would not quit working. They were working 24 hours around the clock, and they must have been on a break because we actually got 10 minutes of silence. And I sang that song, and right as it ended, I just looked at Joel, and I said, I hope you taped that. And then right after that, he said, got it. And right when he clicked on the machine, we heard a big boom of them starting to dig again into the ground, and we laughed so hard, and there was tension because as I was singing, I was wondering, am I going to get through this in enough time? And we recorded it on 2-inch tape, and I was watching the tape roll around, and I don't know, I think it's got a good vibe to it.
And here it is, Medicine, and this is your own composition, I assume.
Yeah,
from the Dreamhouse CD with Steve Poltz. He's going to be in at Sleepy Creek Vineyards on Saturday at for a 7 o'clock show here on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Of a clear blue sky and propped against a tree. I'm slowly counting backwards 7, 6, 5, 4, and 3. It seems I took some medicine and everything is fine. I'll stay here on this rolling hill and slowly numb my mind. I'm floating to a special place where all the drinks are free. The bar keeps, they all know my name and buzz around like bees. And you are still alive and you greet me with a hug. This medicine is kicking in and gives my heart a tug. But I only say I love you if you mean it from the heart. It's hard to hear you clearly, you're a universe apart. But if you say I love you, be sure to say it first. Your words are just like water, you help me. Bobby Fischer playing chess upon my hill, and you're my Russian counterpart, you're feeding me my pills.
The song is called Medicine with Steve Poltz, and he's with me live at the moment from, I mean, I assume you're going to continue to be alive during the rest of the conversation and into the shows.
Absolutely.
In Ann Arbor, Michigan at the moment. And then you're driving up to Minnesota, you said, from here? Nice long drive?
Yeah, driving to Minneapolis, and then we head on over yonder to Wisconsin to play a house concert, and then over to you guys in Fairmont, Illinois, and then Evanston, Illinois, and then we go see a Cubs game and drive home.
That's a lot of driving.
I told you
that when I saw the list, the listing of Sleepy Creek Vineyards, and it said, you know, singer, songwriter, and funny man. And I checked out some various videos, and there's a number of them that appear to be either at house concerts or at, you know, pretty small venues, which makes it a really intimate setting to get to know somebody. And the show, if these videos are representative of the sort of show you'll be doing in Sleepy Creek, is itself really kind of intimate, because you kind of converse with the audience, you tell stories, you tell jokes, you set up songs, and some of the songs themselves are like the one we just heard, you know, very tender, and others are just kind of oddly offbeat witty. Is it going to be kind of you and the guitar and the audience at this particular show? You have your band with you, or what?
Yeah, it'll be myself on guitar and vocals, and then a guy who was in the Rugburns with me named Stinky. He's going to be playing a cardboard box with brushes and some percussion. And
a cardboard box, literally?
Yeah, literally a cardboard box. We mic it, and things he can do with a cardboard box. It's crazy. So it'll be fun.
And is this, I read somewhere along the line that you sometimes do what you call a good old-fashioned sing-along shows. Is this be one of those, or does it depend how it goes?
Yeah, it depends how it goes. There's usually one song that the audience, or two songs where I force them to sing at gunpoint.
How do you decide, if you decide in advance, to sort of mix up conversation, humor, singing? For you, what is the idea of the presentation of the shows?
Well, I don't ever use a set list, so I just come out and just start looking at people and try to feel the vibe of the room and see what kind of mood I'm in. If I'm sleepy, if I'm just ate a big meal, which is usually a bad thing. So I try to go on stage a little bit hungry, and then just see how it goes and there's never really a rhyme or reason, but it just happens. It kind of unfolds. It's kind of magic. I like it that way. I like to be surprised.
You have some pretty serious influences behind some of your songs, including September 11th on some of them. I guess your album Chinese Vacation. And then pretty strong implication, a couple of the songs on this Dreamhouse CD, one of which is an instrumental called A Song for Kosovo. And then there's another song on there called A Dog for Bosnia. What's the influence behind these?
I was over in the former Republic of Yugoslavia just traveling. And I got really involved in talking to all the people and the culture. And I was reading a book called The Death of Yugoslavia. And it was talking about Tito and when he ran Yugoslavia, how he was part Serbian and part Croatian. His mom and dad were both different, and he was able to keep the people together even though they hated each other. And he was sort of a brilliant politician at walking that line. And so I went there after, you know, the war had ended and all everything had hit the fan. And so I was traveling all through all these different places, and I saw this picture of these people in Kosovo walking. It was like an old couple. They were hand in hand. There was a blown out building, and it was like the sky was pretty, and I sort of liked the juxtaposition of the whole thing. And I just started writing that instrumental, and I liked the sound of it. I like how the two guitar parts kind of meet up in the middle. One's ascending and one's descending. And so I was just in this hotel room, and I made up that song and when I was over there.
Who's the other guitarist with you?
I just played. It's just me playing both parts. So
oh, you did an overdub.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. A Song for Kosovo, Steve Poltz, and Steve Poltz on from this Dreamhouse CD. He's going to be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount on Saturday evening. Right, that was a song, well, an instrumental song called A Song for Kosovo, Steve Poltz playing both guitar parts from his album called Dreamhouse, which is your most recent one, 2010. There's quite a few others, some of which are solo. Well, I guess all these are solo, starting with One Left Shoe, Conversations Over a Cerveza, as in a beer, presumably Mexican beer, Answering Machine. Where did you get some of these album titles? The Barn with Songs by Steve Poltz.
That's a children's record. And it's a story about a kid who moves to the country and he moves into this barn, and then the dirt bike starts talking to him, and the cows, all these animals start talking to the kid. It's like he's on acid. And so I wrote, I get to be Dusty the Dirt Bike. It's so much fun. I wrote all the songs for it. I guess I shouldn't have said it's like the kid who's on acid, since it's a children's record.
Well, but in this case, you're the kid who's sort of like being on acid.
Yeah.
I guess. We could say sort of like, as if you ever had done that, which I'm sure you didn't ever. No.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you got to have a pretty good imagination to come up with talking dirt bikes. in various songs. And then, as I said earlier, sort of combined with some serious influences. Talk about Chinese Vacation a little bit, and the events of September 11th, and I guess a close friend of yours was killed. That gets in there too.
Well, it just seems like every album has its own vibe. It's weird. I don't know. Like after that one, I made Traveling and I made Unraveling. And then that gave birth to Dream House. And I have a new one in the works that's done that I got to get mixed that I made in Australia. And I made it in Perth, and it was so much recording over there in Australia. And I just got to get it mixed. And I was just at South by Southwest in Austin. I ran into this guy. His name's Lars, and he's going to mix it for me. This Swedish guy. Of course he's Swedish. His name's Lars.
Yeah.
But so I'm excited for that one to get out and to just keep touring. And
in what sense did the Traveling and Unraveling lead to Dream House? You said it's sort of aside from chronologically.
Well, I do like songwriting games with people where there's a guy named Bob Schneider and Billy Harvey and a guy named Jason Mraz and Tristan Prettyman and a girl named Anya Marina, where somebody comes up with a song title and then we email the songs to each other by a deadline. And so by having deadlines, it kind of keeps me writing. And you just have to send your song in and you have to be accountable. Otherwise, you get dropped from the group. And it's kind of fun doing that because I like having deadlines as a writer. I do better having deadlines. And so you have to use a certain word, we'll say, in the song. It's weird how that spurs on so many different styles of songs and the great things people will write. And so as a writer, I like to, like, I'm going to be glad to go home for a few weeks and just write songs because it's nice to just be home and grab the guitar and not have to play a show and just relax and work on some composition. It's one of my favorite things to do. And then all of a sudden, this song exists, and it never was there before. You can't touch it, but you can hear it. And it's like this neat little creation, and then all day long I feel high from it. It's an addiction.
Well, and you said each album has a character, but its own character. But even within this album, Dream House, it seems like each song has its own character. It really has a wonderful variety to it. And I know for myself, I'd like to explore some of the other albums that I haven't had a chance to hear yet. And I hope that we'll stimulate some folks to go do the same, and certainly to go out and hear your show Saturday night at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount. They encourage reservations. It starts at 7 o'clock, and they don't take reservations online, so you have to phone them at area 217-733-0330, or just for more information, go to sleepycreekvineyards.com. And for a lot, probably better impression of Steve Poltz than I've been able to sort of coax out of this sleepy Tuesday, can be found on his website, where you can actually see a lot of videos of your performances. It's just stevepoltz.com, isn't it? stevepoltz.com,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Poltz.com, P-O-L-T-Z.com.
I'm sorry, yeah, there's no Steve in it, Poltz.com. And, you know, get a lot of sense of what it's like to be at a live show and a lot more of the music. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
And any introduction needed for this song, Killing Myself, to be with you?
That came out of the songwriting game. And somebody came up with the title, Killing Myself. And I just added in parentheses to be with you. And I think it's got a little bit of Roger Miller influence, that one. I grew up listening to Roger Miller. At least I hear a little bit of it in it. And I loved him as a kid, and I still love him now. I was always fascinated as a little kid hearing you can't roller skate in a buffalo herd.
Actually,
that was brilliant.
I haven't even heard the name Roger Miller in years and years, but now that you mention it, I can actually hear some of him in some of what you're doing.
He was amazing. He was such a great guitarist, and he was funny, and I love him.
Had a nice, easy way about his presentation.
Yeah, great delivery. So that's the story behind Killing Myself to Be With You.
I jump up and I fall down. Either way, I hit the ground. Climb a tree and I go so high. Lose my grip and I almost die. Falling through the branches. I'm helpless, nothing I can do. I'm breaking my neck, I'm a scratched up wreck. I let gravity pull me through. No matter what I do, I'm killing myself to be with you. I'll swim the ocean wide and blue to prove to you my love is true. Far across and so deep down, I'll probably sink, most likely drown. Drop into the bottom. I'm helpless, nothing I can do. I'm taking in water, I ain't no otter. I'll let gravity pull me through. No matter what I do, I'm killing myself to be with you. I'm inside an old coal mine, 'cause honey baby you're so fine. I'll blast to the center of the earth if the dynamite don't kill me first. Falling down a mine shaft, I'm helpless, nothing I can do. My pants are on fire, I'm full of desire. I let gravity pull me through. No matter what I do, I'm killing myself to be with you. No matter what I do, I'm killing myself to be with you. I'm killing myself to be with you.
Steve Poltz, he'll be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Coming up next, a conversation with cellist Elisa Weilerstein, who appears with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana Thursday night. Support for our broadcast today comes in part from 40 North, 88 West, presenting the 9th Annual Boneyard Arts Festival, April 7th through the 10th, with venues throughout the county. The festival, in conjunction with the local business community, is a celebration of music, dance, arts, culture, and theater. Information is available on this year's festival at 40north.org. And we have support today from Tire Barn Warehouse and Michelin Tires. After almost 20 years at Prospect and Bradley Avenue, Tire Barn has moved. Tire Barn's new superstore is now located in front of Home Depot on Bloomington Road, Champaign, and will continue to feature Michelin Tires.
Thank you.
That was a performance by cellist Elisa Weilerstein with pianist Enon Barnatan of the part of the opening movement of Chopin's piano sonata, Opus 65. And that was from a recital maybe a year and a half ago or so, live. And she's with us on the phone, actually from Venezuela, in advance of her performance here at the Krannert Center in Urbana with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra. And that is happening on the 31st, on Friday, and or I guess on Thursday. And what brings you or takes you back to Venezuela?
Well, actually, I'm doing a concert with the Teresa Carreño Orchestra of Venezuela, which is, I'll tell you, it's the younger sister of the Simón Bolívar Orchestra, which everybody knows. The Teresa Carreño, they're an orchestra of 60 to 23-year-olds, and they're an unbelievably fantastic orchestra, actually. And they just did their first European tour, and I know that they will do a U.S. tour very, very soon. So it's an incredibly exciting thing to see El Sistema thriving so well. It's just amazing.
Well, and for those who don't know, El Sistema is the system of music education, particularly
right.
Classical music education in Venezuela that has been...
classical music education is what it is, yeah.
Yeah.
And between 300,000 and 400,000 children are now involved in El Sistema throughout the country, and there are several hundred orchestras that are cropping up all over the country as well. So it's kind of a renaissance that's happening here in terms of... classical music, so it's very, very exciting.
And this is not your first appearance down there?
No. I've been coming here actually quite frequently since December 2009. December 2009 was my first concert with the Simón Bolívar Orchestra, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. I did Dvorak with them. I went on a national tour with them as well, national tour of Venezuela, that is. And then I came back and I played with them with my brother conducting, my brother Joshua. And I play with them several other times and with several orchestras here, and I've done a considerable amount of teaching here as well, which is incredibly rewarding, and people are just so hungry for information, and they seem to have endless powers of concentration as well, because, you know, there are no union rules here, so they can rehearse endlessly. They're used to just working endlessly until they really get something right, you know. And there was one kid that I worked with, a really, really talented guy. He was about 13, and he played Elgar for me. And I was working with him, and before I knew it, 3 hours had gone by. And I didn't even realize that the time had gone by. And the kid just wanted more. He just, you know, he didn't want any break. He just wanted to keep going. He could have gone for days.
That's a very long private lesson.
Extremely long, yeah. But I mean, I enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah.
So it's like.
Well, that's a nice introduction, actually, to some news that just came out 2 days ago you've been, well, 2 days ago as of our conversation here, which is happening on the 18th. Yeah, that you just signed an exclusive recording contract with Decca Classics. Congratulations.
That's right. Thank you so much. I've known about this for a few months now, and I wasn't allowed to talk about it until the official press release. So I'm very excited to finally be able to talk about it.
Yeah, well, and the reason that the Elgar was a good mention here is that I guess the Elgar Cello Concerto is going to be your first recording for them, and it's going to be with Daniel Barenboim, who,
right.
I mean, that's got to, I would think that would put some pressure on, because, of course, he was married to Jacqueline Dupré, who has probably the most famous recording of that piece ever.
Right. And she was associated with that, and sort of she still is associated with the piece in a mythical way. And she's also my favorite cellist, so I mean, there are plenty of ghosts there for sure.
So how do you deal with those ghosts?
It helps that I've actually we have done the Elgar before. As you may know, I played with Mr. Barnboim almost a year ago with the Berlin Philharmonic, and that was the Europe concert, which was televised, and we actually did that concert in Oxford, England, which is where, you know, where Jacqueline Dupré was born. That's the city where she was born. And yes, of course, I mean, there's so much associated with it. It's very intense, very loaded. But it helps now that I know Maestro Garenboim quite well now. I've worked with him in many capacities. Well, I mean, of course, the two concerts I did with the Berlin Philharmonic in Berlin and in Oxford, but I've also had several lessons with him. I've gone to spend some time with him for a couple of days just to work through other repertoire, not just the Elgar, but Schumann and Dvorak, and we also played the Beethoven Ghost Trio together, which is a piece that he also had not played since 1970 with Jacqueline Dupre and Zuckerman. So I'm happy to say that we have a really, really nice relationship now musically, and that helps a lot in terms of the trust. And it's something that I still think about. And again, Jacqueline Dupre is my favorite cellist probably that ever lived. So, you know, there's definitely that goes for me. But all I can say is that I do the best I can to serve the music the best I can, and enjoy it while I do it.
Do you find it at all difficult to divorce your own thinking about a performance that is yours, knowing hers so well and knowing her playing so well?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. You know, her playing, as you know, is so seductive, and everything she does is just so convincing and so wonderful that it's very easy, if you listen to her too much, to start copying her.
Right.
And so that's why I actually forced myself to put her recordings away. I have not listened to many of her recordings in many years, in fact, especially to the Elgar, to other things I've listened to more recently, but I forced myself to put the Elgar away when I was about 14. So that I could develop my own voice with it. And I think that was a good move. As much as I adore her playing, and all of her recordings of the Elgar Concerto I adore, but I that was the way that I sort of carved out my own path with it, I would say. And I definitely play it very differently from the way she did, even though I adore her interpretation beyond measure, so...
I wanted to play another piece from the recital that you gave with Enon Barnaton, which is also very emotional, but in a much, much more relaxed way, and that's the slow movement from Chopin's Sonata.
Yes.
I somehow wasn't even aware that he... I guess I should have been aware that he wrote a cello sonata. Is there more than one?
No, only one. And in fact, it's one of his very, very few pieces of chamber music. And probably the best one. So I'm very happy that he designated that for the cello.
Yeah, how convenient. Well, here's that slow movement. It's marked Largo with Elisa Weilerstein and pianist Enon Barnaton. She is going to be playing on Thursday with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra at the Krannert Center in Urbana, 7:30 concert time. And you're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Thank you.
We just heard the slow movement, the third movement from Chopin's piano and cello sonata, or cello and piano sonata, however you want to order that. Pianist Enon Barnaton, and my guest on this portion of Live and Local, cellist Elisa Weilerstein, who's going to be with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra from Russia at the Krannert Center on Thursday. And we're talking actually on the phone from Venezuela a couple of weeks in advance of that performance. And so you're about to start on this 15-city U.S. tour with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic.
Right.
You're still a pretty young player, and Well, and you're therefore making lots and lots of debuts every year, really. What does it feel like to play for the first time with a great orchestra like this, or with any orchestra for that matter, where you've not been before, and everybody's new to you, and you're new to them?
Well, it's very, very exciting. And actually, yes, as you said, I'm young and I'm still making debuts, but I have been doing this for about 15 years professionally, since I was about 13, 14. So I'm 28 now. So I kind of learned how to find my way with a new orchestra, let's say. And in a way, you start to play psychologist a little bit and find out what works and what doesn't. What works with one orchestra may totally not work with another, or with conductors. However, the universal thing that I found that really does work is to treat every concerto like it's chamber music, and that way you really interact with everyone and really pay attention to all the voices that are happening and involve everyone in the process, and it makes it much more fun and much more rewarding musically and also personally. So that's sort of generally my approach now to working with any orchestra, not just the orchestra.
You know, I just noticed this connection as I'm looking at your biography here. You're working with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic on this tour coming up, and you've got a degree in Russian history.
Yes.
Why did you choose that? And at that point, did you think you'd end up having a full-blown career as a cellist?
Yes. In fact, I already did have a full-blown career.
Well, I know you already were, but I mean, you know, you could have...
I was already playing a lot. But yes, I always wanted to... I actually decided when I was in eighth grade that I wanted to go to a university, not a conservatory, because both my parents are professional musicians. I was surrounded... I'm fantastic professional musicians at that, and I was surrounded by a million musicians from the time I was, brought home from the hospital, when I was, newborn baby. I wanted to meet people from different fields and read books, and I was always interested in academics. And I chose Russian history because I loved the music of Russia so much, and especially of the Soviet period. So, Shostakovich and Prokofiev. So that's very relevant to what I'm playing in the next couple of weeks. So that was the reason I decided to go in that direction. But I led a double life while I was in college. I wasn't playing nearly as much as I'm playing now, but I was doing about 50 concerts during the school year, and most of them, of course, were away from New York. So I didn't sleep for 4 years, I would say. I had two full-time jobs.
Well, which you seem to have managed pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the best things I ever did for myself.
I wanted to play another excerpt from that recital with Enon Barnaton, and something a little newer sounding. You did the Benjamin Britten cello sonata with him. Again, this is one that I'm not familiar with, and I'm guarantee
it's
listeners
an
aren't.
Masterpiece.
Yeah, is this something you learned relatively recently, or have you worked at this one for a long time?
Several years ago, actually, and Enon and I play it quite often, so. Hope you like it.
Yeah, well, here's the second movement. It's the scherzo from Britten's sonata. Elisa Weilerstein, my guest, with pianist Enon Barnaton here on Live and Local. Thank you. Cellist Elisa Weilerstein with pianist Enon Barnaton, the second movement of Britten's Cello Sonata. She's going to be with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic on Thursday at the Krannert Center in Urbana. A couple of these awards you've won, I wanted to ask you what's the significance of them in your career personally. You got the Leonard Bernstein Award about 5 years ago and this Avery Fisher Career Grant 11 years ago, when you were a baby now.
Yeah, 11 years ago, that's right, wow.
But those things... Yeah. Those things can be significant in kicking off a career, aren't they?
Yes, yes, and both were, actually. The Avery Fisher Career Grant, when I was 18, it gave a huge boost, and also it gave me some money as well, which I used to pay part of, Columbia tuition, which was very helpful. But, it's an award that everyone recognizes and everyone respects, and so it definitely helped a lot in moving things along, I would say. And the Bernstein Award did a similar thing for me in Europe, 2006, and it actually, from that sort of, there were a lot of events that kind of spiraled from that. I developed a relationship with Eschenbach and...
Christoph Eschenbach, the conductor.
Christoph Eschenbach, yes. And... I met a lot of people that way and formed a lot of relationships that summer when I won the award, and it opened a lot of doors. Both awards opened a lot of doors.
Well, people will, I'm sure, enjoy hearing you play Shostakovich with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic, and who knows, maybe we'll have you in town sometime with, you mentioned your parents who are very fine musicians. Debut recitals with your mom, Vivian. And you still play in the family trio, right?
Yes, a few times a year we play together. So
yeah, it would be great to have you in town.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much.
It's Elisa Weilerstein on FM 90.9. We'll go out with her performance from the Falla suite of popular Spanish tunes. This is the opening movement, the second movement, called Nana, here on Live and Local.